Back to the programme now, briefly referring back to a conversation we had with Dr. Peter Boylan on December the 30th about the rollout of abortion services and the issue of conscientious objection. Dr. Boylan suggested that the position of the Irish Catholic bishops on abortion referral was the same as that of the Irish Medical Council. Well, a spokesperson for the Irish Catholic bishops has contacted us to point out that this is not the case. In the bishops' Code of Ethical Standards for Healthcare, it is not suggested that a doctor should be required to refer a patient for a procedure which in the considered professional judgment of the doctor is unethical. However, it is important to point out that under the new abortion law, Regulation of Termination of Pregnancy Act 2018, doctors who have a conscientious objection shall make such arrangements for the transfer of care of the pregnant woman to enable her to avail of termination. And reading that through this morning before I came down, I can hear court cases rolling along. Should all have studied law, because it's a very permanent and guaranteed employment. Anyway, we're still hopeful, but we're continuing on, but in a different vein. Well, we're still hopeful that is, we will get a deal and all of that. It is prudent for business to start making preparations. So, we're joined in studio by Mark Kennedy, managing partner of Mazars, who's been advising businesses on how to cope with the fallout. If there is a no deal, what are the real difficulties that companies are working on? You break it up in sectors. It's different for different sectors. Yeah. Just a little bit of realism for us all now. What's ahead and how can you prepare against it? And can you afford to?
I think that's a very good question. First of all, thank you for having me on and good morning to everyone. The reality is a lot of businesses have been preparing for the last number of years, particularly larger businesses. And we've heard a lot in the news about financial services companies in particular, what agribusiness companies are doing and so on and so forth. So I think I think it's important to say at the outset that not just professional firms like Mazars, but Enterprise Ireland, IDA and so on have been out in the market for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Advising people on how best to prepare. And it's really a question of strategy. I mean, ultimately, whatever your business, you're looking at, am I exposed to the UK? Am I exposed to sterling? Is my supply chain going through the UK? Am I my people coming from the UK? Am I reliant on them for standards and so on and so forth? So there's a whole load of questions that you have to address. And then really to get down to the nitty gritty, you have to look at it sector by sector. So obviously, if we look as a nation at our exposure to the UK, agribusiness is very, very important.
Yeah.
The big issue there on the goods side is about tariffs, is the initial thing, and also about standards.
How will they work, or do you know?
Well, the WTO has the GATT, the trade agreement structure that's there. If we have a no-deal scenario, we'll start to kick in April. And what that means is that for each subset of product, there will be a tariff in place. And that varies hugely. I mean, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you because there's hundreds and hundreds of classifications.
I know. I saw one in particular that if it costs you, say, 800 euro, I can't remember what the item was, that your VAT might be 96, but some other tariff would be like 200 euro.
Oh, easily. And, you know, in cases such as, I think, in beef, it's close to 50% of the core value. So you're talking about very significant tariffs. Another one that always stuck in my head was in the area of processed biscuits and so on, that even though it's only a couple of euros of a difference, it makes it impossible to sell in the supermarket if you're shipping from here to the UK, because people will buy the cheaper alternative for the sake of a couple of euros in a product like that.
Yeah.
So you really have to look at it case by case from that perspective. So there's obviously an issue there, and I've been listening to you before coming in, and you've been talking about the backstop and the border is obviously a key element of that. The other element in anybody trading in goods is the issue of non-goods tariff barriers and non-tariff costs, and various people like Intertrade Ireland and so on have estimated that could be an additional 20% cost.
On what kinds of things?
So you may have to advertise in different ways if you've got two different jurisdictions. So, you know, there's rules around the how you present products and so on. That can add to your cost. So if you're selling here in Ireland and in the EU, your packaging may be one way. If you're selling into the UK in the future, you may have to package things differently.
Is it not highly likely they'll be identical?
If there was a deal, yes. And I suppose from a business perspective, I think everybody was rooting for Mrs. May to get there, even though everybody knew she wasn't going to get there. But in a no-deal scenario, I suppose you're into competition between countries and these things can vary.
What about companies, and I don't know the range, that say have headquarters in England or have a facility in Britain as well as being an Irish company? How does that work?
Well, you can, I mean, companies, as we can see, with lots of multinationals based here, you can have offices in lots of countries. I think the kind of issues that multinationals will have, say if you take the scenario of something that has a UK parent, we may be subject to different capital rules over time. We may be subject to different standards in terms of if you want to hire professions, they may, currently this is all harmonised and it may change in time. Again, one has to be careful and say, this hasn't happened yet. So, you know, you can speculate that it may arise, but obviously the various professions and institutions and trade bodies will be doing their best to make sure that we stay closely
aligned. Well, if you're a small operator, like an SME, which is responsible for so much employment here and people's livelihoods and wellness, would you need to have a base of some sort in both to ensure yourself, as a backstop, to ensure yourself that even if you only had like a pen over in the other jurisdiction, that you could move around between the two sets of rules?
Could, and I suppose
that costs a lot of money.
It does, exactly. And that's the core issue, I suppose, in many ways. But yeah, of course, if you... It depends on your trade at the moment. So if I take something like the services area, at the moment we have free travel. It makes it easy for our service providers to work in either jurisdiction. The CTA will remain in place, as far as we know. So therefore,
CTA, the common travel area.
So if that remains the case, many services can be provided
that
without.
That's not, that only extends to people. It doesn't work commercially.
And I'm talking about services.
If you're an English haulier and you want to work in Europe, an English bank guarantee will no longer be accepted within the EU member states. So if you need to buy fuel in France and you've got a credit card that's guaranteed by a bank guarantee from the UK, it won't work. So I think that's
But we all use foreign...
But the English financial institutions won't be recognised because the regulation will be different and won't be able to be enforced on.
But if I were a South African citizen and I had a South African bank account and a South African credit card, can I not use that in Ireland or England or France or North America?
But that's not a bank guarantee. That's a credit card.
Oh,
I'm talking about where you're purchasing fuel maybe to the value of 100,000 euros and it's backed up by a bank credit or a bank guarantee. And I think fundamentally for those people, we can actually provide a service because we have many, many office spaces spread around the country, particularly in Wexford. We have Hatch Lab. Perfect for the we have BNY Mellon in Wexford. It's a huge financial operator. We can provide those services. It's a positive for us. Equally, many of my members will have purchased haulage licences within the UK and Northern Ireland. Tomorrow we have a cross-departmental meeting as to see how the rest of the sector will operate. Just remember, we have no milling facility for flour in Ireland. We have many bakeries, but all our flour comes from the UK. Equally, we don't have sugar.
We don't have any milling here.
Only small facilities for organic flour. But the Mainstead bakeries will need to be here and receive flour every day. It can't be stockpiled. So these solutions are something within the service industry that dictates we cannot have delays and borders.
Absolutely. And I suppose the important thing, I absolutely agree with that. The important thing to say, though, is the current situation is that the withdrawal agreement that was proposed covered an awful lot of that and helped us transition it. We don't know what's going to happen next. So I think you have to look at sector by sector what the potential risks are. And when I started speaking a moment ago, I was talking, I suppose, about professional services, particularly where it is people is your business.
Now, Mark, you wouldn't be saying we're not professional.
No, I don't mean in that sense. I'm thinking about lawyers and accountants and so on. But but that could change, and I think that's the point. And I think what we would like to see, and I think in all businesses, is that the UK finds a process by which they get to some sort of agreement. Because at a macro level, the UK is going to do terrible damage to its economy by falling out with no deal.
Not if you listen to Boris Johnson or Mr. Rees-Mogg, and they talk about, you know, free Britain at last, you know, control of our own lives, control of our borders, do deals, all that kind of thing.
Yes, without disrespecting either gentleman, the biggest buyer of goods and services from the UK is the European Union. Mm-hmm. If we have no deal, that trade is going to be interrupted. It has to cause issues. If you take even services, without getting into cars and all the things that people have been talking about, over 100 billion is bought by the top five buyers in Europe every year. So there's no scenario in which the UK is going to gain out of that. The second point is that Liam Fox has been touting a view that he would do trade deals since the day of the vote. He came back last week from wherever he was. He's run up loads of air miles. He hasn't delivered a single trade deal, and he can't until they agree a withdrawal agreement.
Yeah, but if they crash out, if they just out, come to 11 o'clock in the morning.
Let me tell you, if they crash out, we're their nearest neighbour. We have loads of office space. We have loads of talented people. We are certainly the only English-speaking country left in the
UK. OK, Gary, I want to bring you in.
Well, it just goes back to my point about the British voting in certain ignorance. And if you look at the campaign, which I studied quite carefully both at the time and subsequently, it was on emotion. A type of rural Britannia, as Fintan O'Toole points out in his book, kind of a throwback to warm beer and the like. But this idea that they could do better trade deals independently than they could do as part of the EU, that's what's now coming home to roost. But the politics of this remain. And I think also it's quite intellectually valid to hold a Brexiteer position. Yeah. Dan O'Brien talks today, a very good piece, I thought, in today's, and Owen Harris as well. It's quite a valid position to hold. The problem is, though, if they can't get some sort of deal, and a deal, in my view, is as far away as ever, then the whole thing could go belly up.
Paddy Agnew was writing today, too, about what's going to happen in the European elections. And, you know, there's quite a mess in Italy as well with the extreme left and the extreme right. So
it's the contagion effect that Verona mentioned earlier on. And also, if you look at the Basque region in Spain, there are emerging right-wing views all across Europe. Britain going... Why the EU, in my view, cannot yield in one way to the deal it has constructed?
Because
other states could just go.
Yeah, but sometimes the EU doesn't question itself and say, why don't they like us? Why don't they want to stay here?
There has always been a curiously anti-democratic twinge to the EU itself, and we only have to look at our own referendum history here.
I'm keep doing this to you, and I apologise. This is the last break, okay?
Podcast, the Marion Finucane.
Welcome back to the programme. Mark Kennedy, can I go to you on what scale of financial support is needed for businesses to cope with this? Now, to a certain extent, I'm not being dismissive of them, but the very large companies, you know, I saw that they can have their storage in Britain, they can do all those things. That's beyond the affordability of some of the smaller. What can we and Europe do to assist these people?
I think you're right to make the distinction between the larger and the smaller. I mean, there's all sorts of rules in the EU about state aid and provision of support and so on. And for the very large corporates, they've already made their planning. It's certainly incurred costs to them, but it's very difficult to imagine that the EU can support them in that sense. So I think you really have to narrow down to talking about SME businesses.
Yeah.
And I would hesitate to put a number on it. There's people who put far better numbers on those things than I in organisations like Enterprise Ireland. But I could see a very strong argument for supporting SMEs to transition, particularly those, it's a little bit like the affected areas many years ago. So around the border counties where there are many businesses that will be affected. In total, they're not a huge proportion of Ireland's trade. I think we export about 1% of our trade goes to the north, and about 5% of theirs comes south to us. Yeah. So that's a different issue.
Yeah,
it's a relatively, but worthy of support for all sorts of social reasons and other reasons. And then you look at who's exporting to the UK, particularly amongst the SME businesses. And I think there's a good argument, not just in Ireland, but for countries that are affected. And I think that would be fair then. So you look at, say, the port areas of the northern European shores.
Yeah.
There's lots of businesses will be affected quite significantly there. So I think a European-led scheme would be a very sensible thing.
If there's somebody out there putting their fingers in their ears and saying, please don't tell me any more of this.
If you just on that point before you move.
I have first 20
February,
seconds left.
Sean Kelly, MEP, myself and some others will present EU funding prospects in Wexford on the 1st of February. Talbot Hotel for anyone who wants to attend.
Mm. Okay, but if you don't do anything and you just say, please don't let it happen, Lord, is that very unwise?
I think it is taking a risk. I think, you know, one of the most heartening things, I suppose, if I put a positive spin on it, is that I've heard from smaller businesses over the last years, is many of them have reduced their exposure to the UK where they can. And I think that's sensible.
Right.
And I think smaller business.
We're a sector that can't do anything.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Listen, that's all we have time for today. And I would like to thank all of our contributors who contributed to the programme. Broadcast coordinator was Brian Moss. Researchers were Lisa McGough and Rachel Breslin. And today's producer was the series producer, Margaret Curley. As I say, that's all from all of us here. Till the next time, a very good day to you.
The Marion Finucane Show.